Thank you very much for that tremendous introduction, Teresa. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we sit and stand today, and the Honourable Daniel Green and Murray Edwards, and all of you for being here to, I think, respond to this very interesting and challenging problem of mental health and ageing in people with intellectual disability. It's my great pleasure to be really talking very broadly today about this topic and to take you through some aspects from a clinical perspective rather than a research perspective of understanding of the vulnerability to mental ill health that people with intellectual disability experience and the difficulties accessing services and appropriate supports. Obviously, we all come from different directions and different services and angles, and I'm sure you'll be able to relate to many of the difficulties in access to services that I speak of and probably have far more experience of them at the coalface than myself. I'd like to go on then and talk about how we might be able to improve service quality and access for people with intellectual disability, and then finish with some perhaps aspirational or wish list ideas that may come to fruition sometime in the future if there's appropriate funding to support them. It's interesting when you step foot on a different campus. I come from the University of New South Wales, and you notice subtle differences, and one of the subtle differences I noticed was in the bathroom, believe it or not. And here in the bathroom I saw a large bath. And quite unexpectedly, I think if you put a large bath in the University of New South Wales, our students would really have a lot of fun. I'm not quite sure what happens here at La Trobe, but I noted it with interest. So we might come back to that. It's just preferential treatment for men, I'm told. Okay. So this is roughly what I hope to work through today. And we'll start with... I think I've lost some of my slides. Anyway, we'll start with how common mental health problems are and why they occur. Now, you know that there are variable statistics on the prevalence of intellectual disability, depending on the source and depending on whether you lump all people together who have cognitive disabilities in general, or whether you separate out a more tightly defined group of people with intellectual disability, which is probably about 0.9% of the population. But up to 400,000 Australians and up to 125 million people worldwide, so really quite a significant issue. The facts are, the hard, cold facts, that when we compare people with intellectual disability to the general population, that individuals experience an unequal health status. And this is characterised, I think, by poor access to health and mental health care, poor health and mental health outcomes, and higher mortality. And I think this presents a great challenge, and it's why we're here today. In the general population, the data from the National Mental Health and Wellbeing Survey from 2007 shows that 1 in 10 people experience a mental health problem in a month. About 2 people in a year. But for carers of individuals with intellectual disability, this may be as high as 3 people out of every 10 in a year. And for people with intellectual disability themselves, this may be as high as 4 or 5 out of every 10 in a 12-month period. So really a significant overrepresentation of mental ill health and problems. This is a tabulated summary from a study by Anna Cooper in Glasgow in 2007 when it was published. And you see the bottom line is that a diagnosis of any mental disorder was experienced in about 41% of the sample. And if you compare that with our national survey, you'll see that about 1 in 10 or 10% of the general population have a 1 month prevalence. So you could roughly equate those figures. But you may note that a large group of people have what are called problem behaviours for people with intellectual disability, about 22%. Now, many times clinically, we're not sure what to make of problem behaviours, but our approaches tell us that a large portion of problem behaviours are contributed to by mental ill health or by physical ill health. And so I don't think we can say that's not the business of mental health services or supports. So what are some of the common mental health problems in people with intellectual disability? Well, they're the same as for everybody else. Depression or mood problems are common, anxiety disorders or problems with excessive worry, problems with drugs or alcohol, particularly in those individuals with milder intellectual disability or borderline intellectual disability, personality difficulties, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, cognitive disorders, and we'll be hearing much more about dementia, developmental problems such as ADHD and Tourette's syndrome, and behavioural disorders or challenging behaviours. Some of you may prefer that term. That list seems overwhelming, but I think there is some positive news in that with appropriate support and intervention, many of these problems can actually be addressed. So why do people have mental health problems? I think, in essence, this is a fine balancing act. Our mental equilibrium or mental health is something that is fairly finely controlled. And there are some factors that mean that our mental health is likely to be worse, and there are some factors that contribute to better mental health and resilience or protection against mental ill health. There are some things we can't change, such as our genes that confer some risk. We can't change our family tree, no matter how hard we try. We can't change past experiences of trauma and abuse, but we can come to terms with them. And this applies, we often think of trauma and abuse in the younger age group, but this also applies to elderly individuals with intellectual disability. We often can't change family conflict except with sophisticated intervention. We may have to deal with a variety of stresses and worries. Often in the situation for a person with intellectual disability, many factors are out of that person's control, and this can be a real source of stress and anxiety. I'm not sure if you can read that, but it says, "I want to learn how to relax, doctor, but I want to relax better and faster. I want to be on the cutting edge of relaxation." I think this person is definitely an academic. But it's missing the point, isn't it? There are things we have to deal with, loss of a role or a job that can impact on our mental health. We may have to deal with loss and grief, particularly as we age as a person with intellectual disability. But there are all sorts of losses that we don't necessarily think about. The loss of a key carer. In my clinic yesterday, I encountered a carer who'd been with a person with intellectual disability for 10 years, and that person had an excellent rapport and communication with that individual and was able to tell me information that was really very difficult to access in medical records or historical records. But the loss of that carer, as was pointed out, as a risk for worsening behaviour, would be really quite a significant thing for that individual to deal with. Our thinking style can impact, so our sensitivity to criticism, the way we think about ourselves in relation to others, the way that our self-talk, the way we bolster ourselves or put ourselves down, our abilities to communicate and communicate our distress to others, our confidence in who we are, and how well we meet the standards that we set for ourselves or that others set around us, bearing in mind we're setting standards for people with intellectual disability in regard to a whole host of things every day. Some of you were smiling. Perhaps you can relate to that man cutting the scissors. If you can, please see me afterward. How confident we are in relating to others, in particular around social anxiety, being anxious in social situations, the impact of our physical health on our mental health. So there are a number of health problems that have direct impact on the brain and direct impact on things like mood and anxiety state. Having a chronic health problem or limitation, particularly chronic pain or undiagnosed medical conditions in individuals with intellectual disability. Having health problems that directly affect the brain, including blockages to or small strokes in the brain, so blockages to blood flow, and may over time create a vulnerability or be a risk for things like depression, particularly when its onset is later in life. Trauma to the brain, such as head injuries, can increase our risk to a whole host of things, including things like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and dementia. Abnormal electrical activity is a real risk factor in people with and without intellectual disability. Suicide risk for certain types of epilepsy is up to 15 times that of the general population. And so an individual with epilepsy in addition to other disabilities may have a significantly increased risk. Some medications can impact health directly and mental health specifically. There are some blood pressure medications that cause depression, for example. We all know that drugs and alcohol can affect mental health. And then it's on to positive things. So sometimes our genes can be protective, and that's why you see some families with some clusters of mental ill health and others relatively free from it. A harmonious family. Do any of you remember the Brady Bunch? Yes, so do I. Stimulation across the lifespan. I think an increasingly important topic as we think of vulnerability, particularly to later life conditions such as dementia. We know that the richness of our lives lived before the onset of dementia is protective against dementia, but we don't necessarily apply that knowledge to people with intellectual disability. A healthy diet is really important. No drugs and less alcohol. Exercising your brain, really important to build up its reserve. Being able to relax, can any of you relate to that puppy in the chair? Doesn't look like the one I deal with every day. Dealing with problems, showing a degree of grit and determination despite problems, which is more of a personality characteristic, I think. Having good social networks, staying physically active, particularly as we age. Being able to say no. And how hard is that for a person with intellectual disability, where external controls are maximised and the personal control, the person-centred approach is not necessarily applied? And there are some vulnerabilities that are more for women and some more for men. So obviously women have children, so problems after childbirth is a feature. Women tend to have more depression and anxiety, and men tend to have more alcohol abuse and other substance abuse. But other major mental illnesses are roughly equally as common in men as women. In later life, there's some good news. So in later life, we tend to have an inoculation against the impact of stress. We tend to build a resilience through life experience, and this results in lowered rates of depression and anxiety. Schizophrenia tends to be less common, and behavioural problems in people with intellectual disability seem to improve. Think about yourself, think about your behaviour as a teenager, and think about it now, assuming you're no longer teenagers. Most of you don't look like it. Think how your impulse control has changed. Think how your judgments have changed. And you can understand why behavioural problems in people with intellectual disability may also improve with age as those frontal lobes mature. Sometimes they over-ripen, and that's probably something Jenny will talk about later in her dementia segment. But there's some not so good news. Cognitive disorders become increasingly frequent in late life and are up to about three times as common in people with intellectual disability. And then there's mental illness triggered by other health concerns, for example, after a stroke. For carers, mental health is a significant concern. The caring role does have an impact in some individuals. And I think for people with intellectual disability, there's some research showing that the type of disability, degree of disability, the closeness you are to that situation of caring and supporting that person, the type of relationship you have with them and the quality of that caring relationship, the presence of behavioural problems, your financial resources, social supports and your coping strategies are important. And I think it's so important that we don't just think about the person with intellectual disability, but those around them. And often we don't ask enough questions about how the person caring for the person with intellectual disability is faring. So you can see it's quite complex, and I've just put most of the little graphics there. So overall, if I summarise, there are these biological factors: genes, changes in the brain, the risk of seizures, the brain biochemistry, and physical health problems and pain which might impact. There's the psychological, how we think about ourselves, our coping style, our communication skills, how we interact with the world around us and with individuals around us, our social skills and our social spheres. And then there's an interaction between these factors. So some things, the biological, might interact with the psychological. Some things might interact between the biological and the social. Good illustration is someone with tuberous sclerosis who has some obvious facial manifestations of that condition may be socially anxious and avoidant and therefore may not develop the social confidence and the buffer against mental illness that you might otherwise expect to develop. And there's interaction between the psychological and the social, obviously. So a bit more positive, some tips for maintaining good mental health for people with intellectual disability and carers, looking after stress levels, improving how we cope, looking after the mind and body in all of the ways we've just talked about, dealing with problems early and asking for help when you need it, letting somebody else help, which is sometimes hard as a carer, and learning how to help someone. So skilling up, learning mental health first aid, learning how to ask people whether they're okay. These are some of the tips that I think we can use. We don't often think proactively about preventative mental health in people with intellectual disability. We're so tied up with the emergencies and the difficulty accessing services that we don't stop to think enough about how can we improve factors that are general background risk factors for mental ill health. And I think that's where the greatest impacts can be made. So we're on to a framework for addressing mental health inequalities. People with mental health problems do have trouble getting help. We know from good Australian research done by Stuart Einfield, a long-term study where he looked at children and adolescents with mental health problems and behavioural problems and tracked them over time, that only 1 in 10 of those individuals received a mental health support over a long-term period, over up to a 14-year period. That's quite profound. If you think the general population, 1 in 3 people who need a mental health support access it in a year. In people with intellectual disability, some of the data suggests a figure way, way lower. So there's obviously a critical issue with access. Why is it harder for people with intellectual disability? It's harder at every level, it seems. GPs may lack experience and knowledge. Mental health services are really focused on crisis and focused on particular disorders and focused on people who generally can tell them what's going on and who are cooperative with treatment to a varying degree. And staff don't have specific training in this area. Psychiatrists and psychologists generally lack any input in their non-specialist training in this area and so are ill-prepared. And there's been a general demedicalisation of disability, which has been a wonderful thing in itself, but it's meant that medicine, and particularly psychiatry, has then chosen not to take the responsibility it should for serious mental illness in individuals with intellectual disability. It's a convenient excuse to walk away from the area and say, that's disability, it's not mental health. But there needs to be some change to that. And then there's a lack of interagency ways of working, and we'll talk a little bit about that later. From the perspective of the person with intellectual disability, some people find it more difficult to know when to ask for help, to push for something to be done for their problem, and to say what's wrong. And obviously, as I said before, mental health awareness and preventative programs are generally lacking in the whole field. Support people and disability workers also may not know exactly what to look for, how to pick up signs or early signs of a mental illness, may lack specific training, may not know how to access help, or may be frustrated when they do decide to try and access help at the lack of ability of the service they approach to take up that challenge. And there may be a difficulty in coordinating between services. From a primary care and community health perspective, as I said, GPs often lack training and can't be supported or can't access appropriate specialist supports. So if you're a general practitioner working with people with intellectual disability, you can't get backup by a psychiatrist with expertise. That becomes a very difficult situation for you professionally. And there may be some difficulty liaising with and mobilising disability services because it's really not part of the sphere that you usually interact with. You're more used to the medical system, which you know how to navigate. From the perspective of a specialist, and both Jenny and I are psychiatrists who work in this area and in old age mental health, it can be hard to coordinate mental health supports across settings. The level of complexity can sometimes threaten to overwhelm. There can be diagnostic difficulties and treatment difficulties that are really hard, and you need to have a professional network that supports you as a specialist in the area as well. Sometimes, of course, a mental health problem may present very differently in a person with intellectual disability, particularly the person who has a severe or profound level of disability, and there can be communication problems. And so what you may see is behaviour or behavioural equivalence or of the mental health problem. And that at first glance, when the mental health service or professional looks at that, may not be recognised for what it is, a presentation of a mental health problem. Sometimes changes in thinking and behaviour, though, can be mistakenly considered normal for a person with intellectual disability. If there's a really high background level of challenging behaviours and that changes a little bit, sometimes that may not be recognised as the onset of escalation of a pre-existing disorder. Sometimes, of course, what looks like a mental health problem is something different entirely. And sometimes the lack of sophistication of the service and their experience with people with intellectual disability might lead to a label that's completely inappropriate. So a good example is a stress response in a person with intellectual disability that might be mislabeled as a serious mental illness, when what the person needs is appropriate support to deal and manage with that stress. This is a lot of information, so I apologise. We're up to the framework and some projects, current and future. I think any framework that attempts to address the mental health inequalities for people with intellectual disability needs to start with principles. We need to understand the context in which we're operating and what we may be able to achieve in the current context. It needs to build capacity across key areas, involve specific projects and key initiatives, and also has to have a really futuristic kind of look. I like to start with the UN Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities of All Sorts. And I've put mental health where health exists in this document. Article 25 in the UN Convention, if you're not familiar with it, deals with the right to access to health services. And if you put mental health, it really personalises it to the mental health space. But essentially, we're supposed to aim for the same range and quality and access to appropriate mental health supports and specific supports that are related to the disability itself, the mental health aspects of the disability. And so we're supposed to be fulfilling our obligations under this UN Convention of having a group of professionals willing and able to address these issues and a system which doesn't discriminate. And I just wondered if you reflect on your experience with services, with health and mental health services, whether this is actually your experience. Australia has signed this convention and ratified it, signed in 2007, ratified in 2008. And I don't think in regard to health services that we've come very far. And I think we need to move. The WHO put out a news alert on the 25th of January this year, and the WHO Executive Board issued a draft resolution calling for better services, better care for people with disabilities. And so again, you can see at an international level, there's a real push to do something. We have a very good system of care generally, of healthcare in Australia, but we don't cater well to people with disabilities and intellectual disabilities specifically. So I guess what I think from where I stand is that we need a system which is reflected in which people with intellectual disability are embedded in policy, embedded in funding models, embedded in service models, and embedded in the education and training that health staff receive. And I think there need to be specific mental health initiatives. But of course, we need to understand the context. We have an ideal opportunity right now, with the NDIS being rolled out, at least in part, with person-centred planning and funding, with a growing consumer lobby in this area, with a variety of mental health commissions, both the national and several key state ones, with an awareness within disability sector of the need to address this. In fact, more of an awareness and willingness than health services, and with professional bodies. For example, our own professional body, the Royal Australian New Zealand College of Psychiatrists, acknowledging that work needs to be done in this area. We now have a special interest group within the college. So this is a great opportunity. But the Australian context is one where actually provision of services is difficult. You need, at some level, at the tip of the iceberg, are really highly specialised services, but we have a population that's really quite dispersed. So we struggle, I think, with the traditional kind of models, tiered models of health services. And we struggle to have appropriate outreach to more remote areas. There are these five key areas that I've chosen to focus on: workforce, health service, policy, research and clinical, that I think are pivotal in improving outcome. I think the provision of tertiary consultations, as I said, is right at the tip, but But down at the bottom, there are initiatives that need to be very broad-based. We have coming up a national round table on intellectual disability mental health in May, funded by Department of Health and Ageing. We have a push, and we're involved in the development of national guides for mental health services in terms of their capacity and what their responsibilities are to people with intellectual disability. There are projects like the one we're running with New South Wales Health to develop core competencies for mental health staff. We're looking at developing service models in New South Wales for public mental health services. And obviously there's a provision of tertiary consultation there as well. There's a need for a broad-based policy to make sure that people with intellectual disability are included in broad-based mental health policies. They're not readily included at the moment, and I keep banging on about it. And I think we need to keep lobbying for that to occur. And we need a clear policy framework and a way of ensuring that there's a tick box. There's a tick box for other minority groups when you're developing policy in most state and Commonwealth government departments. People with intellectual disability aren't there. If we're going to make a difference, I think they need to be. And we have research, the need to do very broad-based research. We don't have any outstanding epidemiological studies. Teresa alluded to a study that Jenny and Teresa and I are involved with, and Natalie, which is a study of ageing and intellectual disability, but we do need epidemiological work like that to be funded. We need to have data accessible and be able to be interrogated. One of my big concerns is that the way the privacy laws are, it often prevents access to Commonwealth held data on people with intellectual disability, because the majority of people don't have a formally appointed guardian. They have a person responsible under the Guardianship Act. Therefore, you can't get approval for access to that data. So it's very hard to interrogate that sort of data to look at outcomes. But that needs to change. In terms of what needs to be done clinically, the ideal model within a public mental health service would be to have a special team that actually assists with the assessment and management of people with intellectual disability, which services emergency presentations, consults on cases where there's an admission or ongoing management. We need to have community access. We need to have clinics that are accessible for the public, free of charge, with the appropriate expertise. And we need to have tertiary clinics such as the one that Jenny runs and the one that I run. And the capacity, I think, for more complex case review. In terms of workforce, a number of initiatives here, but we need a broad-based education strategy. We're involved as a group in auditing medical and nursing curricula nationwide. And we hope that that will lead to the development of proposals for inclusion of minimum content in those sorts of courses. We have the capacity in the future to develop subspecialty training within our college. We have training for mental health staff on the way with a variety of initiatives that Chris, and Jenny and others here are involved in, and myself. And we have the capacity, I think, to now train new psychiatrists in the area in some areas with some funding mainly from Disability Services and the Commonwealth Government. I've mentioned a few of our own projects. You can have a look at our website if you're interested in any of them. It looks a little bit like that. That's some of our team. It's grown a bit further since then. That was our Christmas snapshot without the Santa hats. We did have one with the Santa hats for the Christmas card. A Facebook page if you love Facebook. We'd love you to have a look at that. I won't talk more about that work. Hopefully we'll make slides available later, but you can have a look for yourself on that website. I will say that we're involved in an initiative which is health and disability funded to develop online education materials that will be launched in the middle of this year, with an initial 7 modules that are directed toward mental health professionals. And there'll be everything there from the basics of intellectual disability through to more complex information about how, as a mental health professional, you should approach challenging behaviour. Eventually, with further funding, we will have the consumer and carer portal open as well, but that's work in progress. We're involved in a data linkage study, which is a statewide initiative. Trying to link all of the relevant data sets, including emergency, inpatient, community mental health, mortality data, and eventually schools and administrative bodies such as our public guardian, mental health review tribunal. So what does the future hold? Well, it's a bit like gazing into a crystal ball. I'm hoping it looks like this. But the way the state-based Treasury speaks and the current federal treasurer, I'm really doubtful. So we have to make do and try and have initiatives that are funded within existing models, and we have to make better use of the dollar to actually make sure that it does address the health inequalities and mental health inequalities related to people with intellectual disability. There are some key things coming up that I think it would be really important for you to know about. The National Mental Health Roundtable in October, and you can read this later, but essentially hoping to increase the awareness of this issue and to set some priority or agenda to take forward to government around this issue. The Accessible Mental Health Services for People with ID, which is a guide we hope to release toward the end of the year. An analysis of mental health policy that we're planning to start this year. The Core Competencies Project that I mentioned briefly, the medical and nursing curricula, and then broader initiatives that I think we should be linking to as a lobby group, the National Mental Health Commission, and the state-based ones. I don't think Victoria has a mental health commission, is that correct? But really it would be lovely to see other states coming on board so that this area can be championed at a state-based commission level. We've certainly put submissions to the National Mental Health Commission who've shown some interest in it being a focus. Obviously the first year focus had to be on Indigenous mental health, but maybe subsequent years intellectual disability will get some airplay. There are some other exciting things happening in New South Wales, if you're not aware of them, relating to a service framework, health service framework that's been built up and relating to an agency for clinical innovation, one of the pillars of New South Wales Health, that has as its focus the health of people with intellectual disability. And that has a website that I've neglected to put there. The development of an understanding between health and disability services around access to and provision of support for people with intellectual disability and mental health problems. That's obviously a document available on the website that's being rolled out in each local health district in New South Wales and could provide a model for other jurisdictions where there are issues. So I'll actually stop there because I'm way over time. And thank you for your time. I'm very happy to discuss any of the issues over the food later if you're shy, or you can ask a question now if you have one.